Today is Monday, the 24th of November, 2014, and we have to go further despite all the tragedy. We dedicated the shiur yesterday in memory of the four Kedoshim. I spoke about two who I knew very well. Besides the Twesky boy, the Kapinski boy, Lo Aleinu, I grew up with his father in the Bronx. And Stanley and I go back, I remember when Stanley was, you know, more or less born 74 years ago, he's 2 years younger. How many Frum kids were there in the Bronx? You could count them on the fingers of the two hands, might have been too much. And the Nebuch, and this poor Aryeh buried a daughter 2 years ago, died in her sleep, a 12-year-old girl. And he has one child who's educationally challenged. My middle daughter is in special ed, took care of the boy. And it's just a son rode fason. I need not tell you, Twesky, what he had in his blood. And you have to hear yesterday's shiur. I commented on questions I get, why the Rav's grandchildren are so right wing. So I don't want to repeat myself, let me go further. Now, what we've spoken about, we're now here in the history of Torah in the United States. It's the third year we're into this shiur, and as I explained to the class, I always teach what I don't know. And all my other classes since the Kollel opened in 1978, I've never repeated a shiur in Sunday or Monday, and Sunday the Shas and Paiskim, Halacha, etc., Shalab and Shuvah, it's a different world. Monday is more of the lighter side of Torah Hashem Tamima. And with my mother's death and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's illness, for the first time I realized my age. Kol zman you have a mother, you have someone in the morning. I would visit her every morning and she would say, Ani, how are you? And at that moment you're a kid again. And then I realized that the history of Torah in the United States, there are many things I've taught that I'm the last person standing who can teach this. So I have to get out of my system. This is the third year now. We're not going to finish this year either. We have a lot more to do. We're not going to finish next year either. God should give strength. Now, we're dealing with Rav Shmuel Belkin. We're dealing with the second president of YU. We've been dealing with him, I believe, since the term began at the end of August. I mentioned a week or two ago that when Rabbi Belkin went to Providence to study at Brown University, he was very friendly with Rabbi William, and the name is pronounced Rabbi. I want to thank Rabbi Michael Tratch, my dear student, who sent me interesting material, but he corrects my pronunciation. He knew it's Rabbi Broda. Am I pronouncing it right, Mark? Let me know. Broda. It's B-R-A-U-D-E, pronounced B-R-O-W-D-E-H. Now, Mark knew him when Mark was rabbi in Boca Raton. Rabbi Broda lived there. We learned Mishnah together. He translated the Midrash Tehillim, and he was a scholar. He told me some interesting things. Avram Yoshua Heschel, as a high school student, was Broda's tutor in Europe. Dr. Belkin was Masada Kedushin when Rabbi Broda got married, and Rabbi Broda was the best man at Dr. Belkin's wedding. He once told me that he asked Dr. Belkin if perhaps he should become an Orthodox rabbi. Dr. Belkin told him to remain a Reform rabbi. He had an important job to do there. In parentheses, Mark writes to me, Rabbi Tratch writes to me, my sense is that this was a kind way for Dr. Belkin to dismiss such an absurd idea. End the parentheses. I don't know if that's correct. If you recall, the Lubavitcher Rebbe felt that Professor Liebman is at the seminary. He told Professor Zlatnik, "Du darfst bleiben." Professor Liebman is dort. You have to remain there. So there's something to be said. If you see someone doing good work among the Reform, the Conservative, maybe they should remain there. So I'm not certain Mark has it right. Now, he told me, this is what we spoke about last week in class, he told me, put on a yarmulke to return from marching with Martin Luther King in Selma. He said that the blacks wore freedom caps, and he was inspired. The following Friday night, he returned to his classical, it should be classic, I believe, Reformed temple, put on a yarmulke, and made a Shechiyanu. He received much criticism. I have a copy of that sermon in my files. Okay, so that's adding a little bit about Professor Browder, who we spoke about in passing because of Dr. Belton's relationship. Relating to what we said last week, that over the years, the schism became so sharp between the writing world and the YU world, and Dr. Belton was spared because the lightning rod was the Rav. The Rav Avram, whenever there was criticism, the criticism was against Ellie, against the Rav. Not against Dr. Belton already was a secondary figure compared to the Rav, and Dr. Belton can do what he did. And we mentioned at the funeral for Dr. Belton, the right-wing world wasn't there, even when the Rav died outside of the Feinstein family, who was there? And Nachum Lam, my Talmud, writes, as a student at MTA, I was a nusher at the Askara for the Rav, held around his shloshim. At his levaya in Boston, which was Erev Shvi Shel Pesach, less people were there, obviously. More people came to this at yeshiva. I remember the Feinstein brothers were there. That means Reb David and Reb Reuven. But so was Rav Pam, my brother's Rebbe at Torah V'das. Rav Pam was always a bit different than the standard Gadol. I remember when his Art Scroll biography came out, my brother was upset and called the author, whom he knew from Torah V'das, and asked him, why didn't he include X and Y, things not standard for Gedolim? Why didn't he describe Rav Pam accurately? The answer is that he wanted to, but Art Scroll wouldn't allow it. Charedei Das Torah seems to me less listen to the Gedolim and more the Gedolim say what we want them to say, ironically. So that's a comment there. Finally, and I consider this a very important document, my Talmud Josh Schneider, West Hempstead, these are real wonderful Talmidim who learn and take everything seriously. They're not just monkeys putting on tefillin. There's Elichkeit. I know them each personally. So, a volume came out that, you see, today we have a terrible problem with books because unless you write a novel about sex and crime and money, then you write a book, you get an advance, they give you $500,000. Alex, think about it. But you can't use your name. You don't want to be disgraced. So you don't want to use Alex Glassman. You would use Alex Hausman, you understand? So let the world not know who you are. So you get the money up front, and then the publisher is interested in selling because he has to make money back. Like Clinton's book fell flat. They gave her a tremendous advance, and the sales have not equaled what they gave her up front. And we have a tragedy in our world, which you saw with the book launch of fourth edition of Revel and Silver. The OU publishes it in New York. They didn't even send one copy to the OU here because they don't give a hoot about selling books. Why? Why should they? They made their money up front. People gave on my good name. It hurts me. People had a shnur money. My commitment had a shnur money on my name. The books published, then they could take it, publish 2,000 books, throw them into the Harlem River. What do they care? They got more than they needed up front. And it's a terrible situation. And the same thing with books. The press, the university presses that come out with the, oh, what you missed already. Yitzhak, you aggravate me. That's all I can say. We spoke last week, and I'm reacting. I'm giving me, okay. Someone's saying some. I'm taking up a collection for Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin to buy him a watch with an alarm in it. Okay, I the first dollar I put up. Now, with the university presses, it's the same story. They're endowed. Glassman makes $1 million writing a book about sex in the yeshiva, and he gives $1 million to some university press to publish books. So they don't publish, you follow me? You understand it? They don't publicize either. Anyway, there's a fabulous book that came out that I highly recommend to you, A Jewish Life on Three Continents, The Memoir of Menachem Mendel Friedman. It was written originally, I believe, in Yiddish, translated into English by his grandson, Lee Shai Weisbach. Published Stanford University Press, Stanford, Connecticut. I've quoted the book before. Now, what makes this book very fascinating is he is a Talmud Chacham, a Yudapeyish Talmud Chacham. He learned in yeshiva. He did not get smicha, which in retrospect was a tragedy because he was a big Talmud Chacham. He was offered positions in America and he would have been a wonderful rabbi, but he fell to a Maya and left smicha. Instead, he became a businessman. But what's fascinating about this book, it's a memoir without an axe to grind of Europe. Then he comes to America, and then he goes in Aliyah in the early years of the state of Israel, and he lived about two blocks from where I live, about three blocks from where the Tarragons live today, where you live. You understand? He davened in Yad Tamar. I didn't know him personally because he died maybe 25, 30 years ago already. I'm living there 45, 46 years, but I was davening in Old Rivka. But I'm sure I saw him. It's just I didn't know who he was. I was a kid. No one introduced me to him. Now, he wrote a fabulous memoir. And here you have a Dudne Emma. You understand, Messiah, and if you've learned halakha, you know that a guy is believed if you walk into a shop in London and a guy is selling, and without saying a word, you walk in, he says, this is kosher, this is not, you can believe him. Guy Messiah lefi tumo, right or wrong. So the whole question, remember we touched upon it in class, why did the Lashon Yeshiva close down? A very interesting question. And the right-wing world, the art-scrolled world, tells you it closed down rather than introduce secular subjects. And then the question comes up, Heshir Rav Schechter writes about it, why the Rav, his grandson, this relation. All right, that's a different question. The Rav was not his grandfather. And learning he was perhaps his grandfather, even though his father, Rav Moshe, one time someone said to him, I heard this from Rav Michal Katz, that Rav Michal, when he first read Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, when he came to America in the late 30s, so he said to Rav Moshe, Izun is Azevi de Zeda, your son is like Rav Chaim, your grandfather. And Rav Moshe said, Chas v'chalila, my son is great, but can't be compared to Rav Chaim. But in learning, I'm a Talmud, I have a right to compare him to Rav Chaim, but he was so much broader, how can it be Balazhin? Anyway, once again, we now see that the files of the Russian secret police that were first opened after the fall of communism do not lie. And on page 2, Friedman says very simply, following a dispute between the administration of the yeshiva and the Russian government, which thought the yeshiva students to be revolutionary. And that's exactly what the files in the secret police indicate. There was a big machloket who should be the next Rosh Yeshiva. The Netziv wanted to go in Aliyah. He was on in years. Mivet Alta, you know, you grow older, you grow older. You can't do what you did when you were younger. And the Netziv appointed Rav Chaim Berlin, his son. And the students, this is what's going on in Panovich today, except in Panovich now, it's beyond words. If I was running the country, I'd go into Panovich and take the whole yeshiva into the army for 2 years. You want to fight? We'll let you fight. But fight for a proper cause, you understand? Compare Panovich to what's going on in Lubavitch in Crown Heights now with the shluchim. What is it? 5,000 shluchim, b'shalom, b'ava, b'achva, v'reyot. And Kolakavald, and take a look at Panovich. So in Volozhin, and all the Panoviches, when you meet them and you talk with them and you try to knock sense into them, they say to you, how are we any different than Volozhin 1854? Those in Panovich who know me say, you lectured about it, you gave lectures, the big machlokes. that machloka today, machloka tomorrow. But as far as I know, in Panovich, in Voloshin, in 1854, no one beat the heck out of a Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Berman already had it, was taken to the hospital. No one threw food in a Rosh Yeshiva's face. Am I right or wrong? What do you say? What do you say? Am I right or wrong? What's going on today? But that's what went on. The students told the Netziv, the great Netziv, seeing the Hasidic world, this couldn't happen. But the Netziv, they told the great Netziv, go fly a kite. We want Rav Chaim Briska. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik wasn't Rav Chaim Briska yet. We want Rav Chaim, your grandson-in-law by marriage. We want Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav Rafael Shapiro's son-in-law. And the Russian government was frightened stiff. They're fighting like crazy. The Russian government tried to intervene. And they shut the yeshiva down. They figured if these guys learn how to fight, they're going to be revolutionaries. And it's true. Some of the people who shot guns, who were hanged in public afterwards, were yeshiva boys who were after the Tsar, revolutionaries. Okay. Now, let's come back here. So those are just addendums to what we've mentioned in earlier Shayurim. But that volume by Frieden, I cannot praise it enough or recommend it enough. When I picked it up, I couldn't put it down. I just couldn't put it down. Europe, America, and then Palestine, Israel. And he describes Israel as it was in the early 50s, the mid-50s. He describes how he goes to in Sahala, it's called Sahala, it's beyond Tel Aviv, an area built for the offices of the army, beautiful area. This is North Tel Aviv. This is, in modern Hebrew, we have an expression. Rabbi Wagner, you never heard this expression yet. If someone says to you, you're a tzfoni, you're a northerner, you know what they mean? No religion, drugs, dope, free life, wine, women, song, you know, the Obama's world, Clinton's world. That's the expression. It was publicized by a big balat shiva who wrote a book, Mikimi, and the expression is, you're a tzvoni. So he had a son or a grandson in the army, an officer, and he spends some time in Sahava, and he describes no religion whatsoever, no connection to Yiddishkeit, nothing. Brave soldiers, high-ranking officers, no concept of Shabbat, of Chagim, of Kashrut. That's the way he describes. Could you imagine? And look where we're at today in the year 2015, that we have brigadier generals v'sfafelin nishtamincha. They don't miss. Generals, why major generals? Who would ever dream one of the three candidates for the next chief of staff is a yeshiva boy? And if you know General Naver, if you see him not in uniform, so it's like, Rakefet, what's that man's profession? I'd say he's a shul gabbai. I danced with him once at a Hachnasat Sefer Torah. You hear the guy speak, you see him write Divrei Torah in the weekly Torah sheets. You see him write Divrei Torah in Makar Rishon. And this man, Skan Ramat Kal, look where we're at, Major General. And we have a Brigadier General who will succeed his father as a Hasidic Rebbe. That's in Gila, Friedman. On one side he's Arushina, and the other side his mother is the sister of the Vishnitz Rebbe, of the one who just died. She's an aunt to the present Vishnitz Rebbe. It's a brother to the Vishnitz of Satma Pikoris in Munsi. You follow? That's a brother of the Vishnitz. I don't want to mince words. I get sick when I mention his name. Let me go into my world. Eli, I'm a good Jew. I have one value in life, Torah. Nothing else. T-O-R.
What about the Yankees?
That's not a value. That's a diversion, so you forget about what's going on in Panovich. And the Yankees today, you need a diversion from the Yankees. Say, what teams, what we grew up with, Joe DeMar, you're talking here, a basketball star. We're going to get there, if not this week, next week, you'll see. Now, so Rabbi Belkin, as we said last week, there's no question he didn't let anything deter him, and he remained firm both mitzad, his commitment to yeshiva, a Litvish yid, and the man who brought and loved America, loved Western culture, and the story his son-in-law, Rav Shulchalter, his son-in-law later divorced, but the father of his grandchildren, etc. Rav Shulchalter, as Vic Geller quotes him, Rabbi Belkin stood up at the end of the TV broadcast when they would play the Star Spangled Banner. And this captures, and I told you, when we came in Israel, television had just begun. It was something new here. Ben-Gurion and Satmar both agreed no television. But Ben-Gurion finally lost out, and they started television, and it was limited hours. And about 11 o'clock at night, they would say goodnight and tell you to go to sleep. It was unbelievable. And they would play Hatikva. And I would always stand up. I didn't know at that time that Dr. Belkin stood up for Star Spangled Banner, but I stood up for Hatikva. And you recall what I told you when I quoted Tova last week. Lo Aleinu, I spoke with her this week, but not for happy reasons. So Tova said, and it's the quote that says, my father and mother gave Kiddush when they became citizens, and we gave Kiddush when we went in Aliyah. And that's exactly catches it. Dr. Belkin, fellow American. And we spoke about his attitude towards Israel. It had, to quote Vigela's sentence, it had his respect, but not his fervor. Okay? That's the difference. Never visited Israel. We spoke about that last week. And here, towards the end of his life, at the most inopportune moment, begins the saga that enables us to sit where we're sitting at this moment in time. The Hashgacha Pratit in this story is overwhelming, and I tell it as it is. I'm going to show you documents, and then I'm going to prove to you that Rakefet is telling the truth, because I don't believe everything I'm saying. It's impossible. How could this all happen? But I'll prove to you it's every word is true. Shmulin, Mr. Gris, we mentioned last week, was not from, he had an older brother, Oscar, a younger brother, I believe, I shouldn't say older. Oscar was from, these were emigres from Poland, came over in the 1930s. They did very well in Poland, and they did even better in the United States. They had a seat on the stock market, and they were wealthy people. Oscar Gris was heavily involved in Moria. Joe Gris was not involved in Yiddishkeit. And then, lo and behold, he had a family problem, and his brother said, I'll take you to my Rebbe, and he brought him to the Rav, and the Rav said to Mr. Joe Gris, I can't really help you, maybe my wife can, and he introduced Mr. Gris to Rebbetzin Tanya. Joe Gris and Rebbetzin Tanya hit it off, and the Rebbetzin was able to help him with his family problem, and he became very devoted to the Rebbetzin. And the Rav shouted at Mr. Gris, why do you have these problems? It's because you didn't give your children a Jewish education. You didn't send them to day school. What do you expect? They have no connection to the past, to the Jewish people. They have no knowledge or understanding of the romance of Jewish history and being a Jew. And Mr. Gris was told by the Rav, you have to start giving money to Jewish education. And Mr. Gris began to give a fortune to Israel. He was very close to Teddy Kollak. If you go to the museum, you'll see a whole section named in honor of Caroline and Joe Gris. His wife was a lawyer. And wherever he gave money, her name was first, which is the way it should be, Caroline and Joe Gris. Gave a lot of money to Torah, gave a lot of money to, though he wasn't observant. It's an amazing thing. But he gave a lot of money to Hasidic causes. You'll see his name all over Borough Park. And Mr. Gris used to say to me, the Kinderlach mit der Peyerslach sein der Zukunft from the Yiddish key, from Windsor Zukunft. They're our future. These kids with the Peyers, they're our future. And he was just fabulous. He said to me, I quote, I heard this with these 2 ears, I don't want to die leaving any money over. All my hundreds of millions of dollars, I want to totally distribute to Stucker before I die. And suddenly, Mr. Gris, who loved the Rav heart and soul, to him the Rav was the greatest Jew alive. He wanted the greatest Jew to teach Torah in the greatest place in the world, Yerushalayim. he envisioned this as an advanced school, like you would say Rehovot, where Professor Tarakan taught for so many, was associated for so many years. If I'm not mistaken, the Weizmann Institute is not regular classes. It's senior research. Am I right or wrong? It's for people who are brilliant in their field, who want to go further in research, and that's the way Mr. Gris viewed what he wanted in Yerushalayim. The greatest Torah teacher in the world and the greatest place in the world in Yerushalayim at this moment in time. The tragedy is the Rav was broken already. He had lost his wife, and that was the ultimate axe that hit home, cut away at him. Dr. Belkin already was broken from the burden of yeshiva. As everyone knows, in the 1960s already, whenever you saw Dr. Belkin, either he was holding a cup of coffee, or he was smoking a cigarette, or there was a bottle, as I'll testify to in his, I'll explain it, but not today, there was a bottle in his drawer, pulled out, a little schnapps, push it to keep going, the Agnes Nefesh. And poor Mr. Gris comes along and he tells the Rav of his plans. And the Rav, by this time, yielded. He was not the Rav of the 40s, the 50s, who could chop your head off in class and then you walked out shaking and shivering. And he probably figured Mr. Gris talked them a cup, and they spoke Yiddish. This was the language that they spoke, the Rav, Mr. Gris, the Rebbetzin, Dr. Belkin, they spoke Yiddish. That was their native language, and they felt most comfortable in it. And the Rav finally said to him, okay, gay, gesundheit, yorich, well, gay, and I'll go, I'll teach, I'll do whatever you want, get him off his back, go build. But with Mr. Gris, you don't play games. He, Taka, built this campus. Beautiful campus. You should know that this campus is zoned for two more major buildings on it. You follow me? This campus is zoned. It's not just what we have. You can build two more major buildings without any, don't have to get permission, you don't have to go to the city council. What a piece of property. Now, this area, when I came in Aliyah 45, 46 years ago, this area was an orchard. All the way up from Rehovotzeel, there was not one house here, nothing on the other side, nothing whatsoever. Beautiful, large parcel of land, but Mr. Gris got to build a educational center. Okay, the center now is ready. 1 year went by, and nothing happened. The building stood empty. I can testify, I was in the building. I used to walk past here every day, 'cause I 3 days a week, because I taught in Mechwala. I once took a student in, maybe you recognize the name, very well known today, Rabbi Dr. Danny Rothenberg. He's a big in psychology. He's head of psychological counseling at the graduate school of the City University of New York, I believe it's called. Took him into the building. I remember turning the water on, showing him the water. Everything is here. No one is here. The building is a ghost, a ghost. Teddy Kolak got involved, and Teddy Kolak started putting pressure on his friend.
He was at?
This is 75. The building was finished by 75. Teddy Kolak got involved and he started putting pressure on Mr. Gris that this building can't stand empty. It's a security risk. Here you have an entire campus built with apartments, and the big apartment in that little building down the hill was dedicated for the Rav, and there's no one here. The Rav is not coming. The Rav is broken in health. Dr. Belkin is not interested. And Teddy Kolak started putting pressure, you have to let the campus be occupied. Now, there's a school in Beit HaKerem. The school exists until today. One of my daughters just got a master's there two years ago. It's called David Yellen Teachers College. David Yellen has a bachelor's program, a master's program. I don't believe they give doctorates. It's the largest school for preparing teachers in Jerusalem. It is non-sectarian. It is like Hebrew University. You have religious students there, irreligious students, you have Jews, you have Arabs, you have men, you have women. In the meantime, bear in mind that this mountainside has been given away. At one end there's Mechala. Mechala already was more or less open by this time. It had moved from Bayit Vagan down into the mountain. They were building next to this campus, Tchorov High School for Girls, Weingarten High School, named by David Weingarten in memory of his mother. He made money. Sharon Tours arranging tours, selling airline tickets. What's the name you would call it? A travel agency. Ran a big travel agency. On the other side of the building was Machon Lev already. It also just about was moving in at that time. It would have been a tragedy because here you have tens of thousands of religious boys and girls coming to this mountainside every day. And right here, second campus, you would have had Arabs, Jews, men, women, dressed, undressed, go to Hebrew U, look at the lawn, and you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about, what would have been here. Now, on the other side of the ocean, and this is the letter I reproduced from Reb David Miller, and the reason I asked Reb David Miller to write and give me the details, because no one knew the situation at this end better than Reb David Miller. And the reason was very simple. I certainly didn't know. I was a kid. I wasn't involved. I was looking from afar. Who knew the name Rakefet, you understand? Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein wasn't involved. He was busy in the Gush. They were first starting to build Yeshiva Teretzion. But there was one person who fought to build a presence in Israel, and that was Rabbi Azriel Miller, Zichron Lefracha. David's father, Rabbi Israel Miller in English. Rabbi David's father, he was fighting. He had the vision. So I knew very well that on this end of the ocean, even though Rabbi David was a young man at the time, he had been in Madrid and BMT, he was first starting to teach, but he would know what's going on. And I reproduced the letter because it's very important. What I'm writing here, no one else will ever write about again, and I want to be sure I'm actually absolutely factual. And what's going on, Dr. Belkin couldn't handle it. He was not well. The Rav couldn't handle it. He was already broken in health, although still stronger and better than he would be a few years later. But the downhill slide was there. The Rebbetzin was not alive. Toba told me years ago, had her mother lived, she believes they would have come in Aliyah, because her mother would have pushed the Rav, her mother, Eretz Yisrael. The mother was grew up with Zionism all her life. On the other hand, you have an institution here that began in 1969. This institution changes the course of Torah history in the Anglo world. It began as a fallout from the Six-Day War. It was a person, Chaim Chamiel, I write about him. He was the mankal for Moshe Krono. Moshe Krono was the head of the Torah Culture Department of the Jewish Agency. This basically does not exist today. At that time, the Jewish Agency was very big in education, Torah Culture Department in Israel, and Chamiel had that insight that the whole world's interested in Israel now. The Six-Day War woke everyone up. It was an explosion. Kids are going to start to come here. Let's create a school. I'll use my words now, but it's the gist of the idea. To export Torah to the Anglo world. And that was the idea. We got to create a school that a kid from New York a kid at that time, they were talking in terms of kids in the middle of college. You didn't come right after high school yet. That happens later, after the Yom Kippur War. But a kid in the third year of college, or a kid who finished college, a kid who's totally anglicized. Are you want to ask something, Shmuley? Yeah. A kid who's totally anglicized. He's going to come and he's going to feel at home. And I'll come back telling now in his language. Very simple. I came in Aliyah. I didn't want to come without a job. So I applied at the Jewish agency. And they sent my CV over to Israel. And who was interested in me? The Encyclopedia Judaica. They were started by German reparations money. Hitler ended what began in Germany. I believe there were 8 volumes of the Encyclopedia Judaica in German. And now they decided to do it, but of course they're going to do it in English, which was the international language of the Jews in 1960, whenever it began. Germany put in heavy money. It was a government project. Kolzmar was a government project, the Chum Chaint of Kum Morgan. Alex, do you know a little Yiddish? No. When I used to see a Jew with a beard, I believed for sure he knew Yiddish. What do I do with you guys? Ich komme heute, ich komme, I'm coming today, come tomorrow.
If you start teaching Yiddish class, I'll come.
No. We have a kid here, Nathaniel Fishman's father. Bring him over from JTS. David Fishman, he's professor of Yiddish. He put out the Rub's talks in Yiddish, the talks that we give him in Yiddish. Put out a whole volume in Yiddish, Ketav Publishing, with the family's approval.
And who's going to read it?
People who read Yiddish, people who hear. The kids, well, if kids want to learn Yiddish. Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. When the Rebbe speaks, I went to Fabrenian here with, when it came in through satellite at Binyanei Human, Yutet Kislev. I looked around. I'm the only one without earphones. I didn't know what earphones were. You know, I'm innocent. I grew up in a world we didn't have earphones. So I asked, what are the earphones? It's a translation from some kind from the Rebbe's Yiddish to English and some kind from the Rebbe's Yiddish to Hebrew. I was the only one in an audience of 8,922 people who were sitting there without earphones. Baruch Hashem, Chafashtan and Yedavad. How do I come to Yiddish? That's a different story. I'm a third. My parents were born in Harlem. Where did I hear Yiddish? But it was swim or sink. We had no choice. The whole yeshiva, everything from seventh grade on, my rabbeim in LA with Shanghai, people didn't speak a word of English. No, I had no choice. And it was min shemayim. Of course, when I worked for the Mossad in Russia, in Minsk, in Vilna, in Riga, in the little cities, that was the language of communication. Moscow, Leningrad, you could use English, you could use Hebrew, you understand? When you spoke, they translated. There I spoke Yiddish. I gave a talk in Vilna in Yiddish. Baruch Hashem. I needed it. I needed it desperately. Okay. So, they begin the school BMT. I'm working at the encyclopedia. I get a telegram. I had no phone in those years. There's the story. I think it's even true that some Natura Katanik got a telephone. He made a kiddush. So he said to him, "Du Shagets du Eisfach. You got a phone from the Zionist system, from the Zionist Medina, and you're making a kiddush?" He said, "I ordered it during the British mandate." So I got a telegram that a guy named Rabbi Moshe Horowitz wants to see me. I still remember where his office was, in the middle of the city. And he says to me, "We're beginning the school, and we have 10 students, and I need someone like you who..." And he knew I had a doctorate in Jewish history. It wasn't Shas and Peskim they wanted from me. And from that, I suffer until today. No one knows that I know anything. They just think I know Jewish history, but I have to live with it, because the Rav called me his... When the Sylvia era came out, the Rav called me his star. He was very pleased, very happy. What's the difference? But so he says to me, "I'd like you to give a course in Jewish history, but make it interesting. They shouldn't be bored." And in the fall of 69, I started teaching in BMT. There were 10 students. Michael Fuhl, Zichron Levracha, was the first student to call me Rebbe. And what caught on? What was my strength? My strength was, here's a man who knows, shot some Paxton. You know, a little bit, 0 degree, but zero so something, 7-7-0, humble, a little bit. He knows Joe DiMaggio's statistics. Ah, oh, the kids used to love to talk with me and learn it. DiMaggio on mantle. You know how many conversations we had in BMT, 69, 70, 71. I'm going to a wedding tomorrow night. A student who first entered my class in YU in Washington, that's 50 plus years ago. And then he came to BMT, one of the earliest students, the middle of college. I take a look, there's Yitzhakin popping up again. And when I had him when he was young, he was a wild kid. Now a gentleman, Derek Herritz. And he's marrying off his youngest child. I had the privilege to be at the wedding. I was at his wedding. Baruch Hashem, lives in Chashmonaim. That was the secret of BMT. Nothing succeeded like BMT. Yes, Shmuley.
Rebbe says that BMT was the first people to be taken.
Geared. It's not like Karen Biavle that had American kids coming over, and then when those kids come back to America, Rabbi Blau, you've heard of Rabbi Yosef Blau, so Jerry Blau said, I'm sitting next to Jerry says to the Rav, the Rav said, and the Rav says, What Rav? Who are you talking about? And Jerry says, Rebbe, I mean you. So say you. You said, what's with you? He came back from Israel, third person. I would come back from Michala, I would tell my wife, wow, 59 girls said to me, Haravama, Kvot Haravama. She said, throw out the garbage. You follow? Whoever heard it. In England, you see, I met people from England, Shomrei Shabbos, when they spoke about that they met the Queen, they cried. When if I would meet Obama, I would rip Korea. You understand? Who the heck? That, so, KBY, no, but that was not BMT. Whitey Hurwitz, Reb Meish Hurwitz, Zichrona Levracha, he was a perfect choice. His father was a shaykh in the Midwest. He came from Hasidic stock. He studied in Chicago with Reb David Lifshitz. He followed Reb David to New York to study with him in YU. He taught for the Rav in Boston. He was principal of a day school. He was a perfect amalgamation of honest Torah. And he's an American kid. It was beautiful. And the rest is history. BMT started growing by leaps and bounds. It needed a new home. It moved. It began in Rehov HaBarbanel, I think it was 23. It moved from Rehov HaBarbanel, around the corner from you. It moved from Rehov HaBarbanel to Rehov Neely, around the corner from me. That building was knocked down. There's a whole housing development there. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Professor Dr. Grach, lives on Rehov Neely 7. It's, that was the second home of BMT, right next to where Reb Chaim lives today. Then it needed a new home. It had land ready to build at the foot of Givat Mordechai. Okay? There's a big high school for girls there today, Jesselson. It's named in memory of Amalia, of Mr. Jesselson's mother. They had that property to build for BMT. But they had a pressing problem. They had 150 students. It was as big as Torah Shraga, even bigger. They need a place. And they were dreaming that they could get this campus. They met with Mr. Gross, and he was an interested BMT. Who heard of BMT? It's not the Rav. Kolek was putting pressure on him. Wasn't interested. Spring of 1976, Jordanian war bonds went up in value, because the Israeli army drafted a guy named Aaron Rakefet. How did they come to draft Aaron Rakefet? Before the Yom Kippur War, no American was drafted. If you wanted to go into the army, you had to volunteer. Why didn't they draft Americans? There was a problem with America with dual citizenship. America was not happy about having its citizens serve in a foreign army. After the Yom Kippur War, which we still don't understand how we survived, Chasdei Hashem. I was here already 4 years at that time. You know how many people I know who were killed in that war. So I'm drafted, basic training, finished basic training, and I did a good job. I mean, my life, I always tell my grandchildren, when you have to do something, you do it seriously. Could be you didn't want to do it, but you're doing it. Mr. Chaim, it's Tayen, I won extra shoko for sharpshooting. I'm not putting you on, I'm telling the truth. I still have my slip, m'upaz, you know what that means, ephes. It all went into the bullseye. So, and then we finished basic training before Pesach, and we're each assigned to what we're going to do in the army. I was in for till old age, Baruch Hashem. So I made a little party in my house for the guys, the Rabbanim in my unit, a lot of, I'll use the word AKs, I won't spell it out, but you get the feeling. There were a lot of older guys, because it had to be in the same age range and health range. And we're sitting around in my house telling stories about how brave we were and how much the army loved us and how the army now is so much stronger because we guys did basic. And we're telling stories and jokes. And there are a lot of funny things happened in Shabbos in the army when we had every meal, we had a different rab speak with a different minhag, a different eidah. Every davening was a different nusach. It was unbelievable. It was a real kibbutz galyut. And, we were older people. We knew how to make it into a real beautiful experience. I write about in the book my drasha Shabbos. I'm lucky I didn't wind up in jail, but that's a different story. You read it. You can read it in Washington, the drasha I gave. So while I'm sitting and joking around, the phone rings. And it's Whitey Hurwitz on the phone. And Whitey says to me, "We want you to meet Mr. Gris tonight. We're desperate. It's our last chance. We're trying to sell him on the idea of giving this campus, allowing BMT in. Bring a copy of Bernard Revel." My first book had come out already a few years earlier, first edition. "And give it to Mr. Gris, a gift. We'll pay you for it." Fine. I was a poor kid then. I mean, giving away a book was, it's not today. It's a poor kid. We had lived through the Yom Kippur War. You don't know what happened afterwards. It's not that they cut your salary. They just took 60% for war bonds, quote, end quote. So you can, and everyone else, I told you more than once, the whole economy was black. But I was working for the government of Israel, Michala, and for the Jewish agency, BMT Gold. All my income is right in the open. You can't put it under the table. The economy was black. Dina de Malchuta, but you can make a good case. If the majority of the money is black, then everyone knows it's black. So that's no Dina de Malchuta applies. Look up the Rambam. You'll see what I'm talking about. Okay. I come into the lobby of the King David. I can show you. I showed my wife. We met people in the King David last week. I showed Malka exactly where we stand. And there is Whitey Hurwitz, Moshe Krona, head of the Torah Culture Department. That's like a sob in Mishalat Yisrael at that time. And Mr. Gris, I say to him, "Mr. Gris, I'm introduced to him, Dr. I don't think they used Rakef, but I think the name Rothkopf was still in the vogue because that's the name they knew me by, from, because Whitey Hurwitz knew my brother, who's a real doctor, Dr. Levi Rothkopf, MD. He knew my brother from Washington, and he knew my name is Rothkopf. And they introduced me to Mr. Gris, Dr. Rothkopf, and I want to show him academia. And I give him a copy of Revel, and Mr. Gris says to me, and I apologize if anything sounds braggart. I don't mean to be braggart. I'm a 0770 person. Has to remain shafel ruach, ma'od ma'od ha'mishafel ruach, as I'll say. And Mr. Gris says to me, "Dr. Rothkopf, I've heard such beautiful things about you, what you're achieving with the American students." And I say to him, "Mr. Gris, whatever you've heard about me is to your credit." And this multi-billionaire looks at me. I said, "Mr. Gris, do you remember when the Rebbetzin was ill? You went to visit him, right? What happened when you went to visit her? You asked the Rebbetzin, was kann ich tun für dich? What can I do for you? And she said to you, Yosef, the Rosh Yeshiva, and why you were underpaid. And at her deathbed, you said to the Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin, I want to make you happy. I'm going to dedicate $1 million for the salaries of the Rosh Yeshiva. He had his face lit up. I said, Mr. Gris, my salary doubled overnight. I took that money in 68 and visited Israel for the first time with my wife and my two eldest daughters. We vowed to settle within a year. We came back 10 and a half months later as Ovim Chadashim. I'm only teaching in BMT thanks to you. You deserve the credit. And with those words, we fell on each other's shoulders and cried. And then I said to Mr. Gris, I know you're very upset the Rebbe's not coming, but what is Torah about? Torah's about Mesorah, about continuity. I said to Mr. Gris, yes, the Rebbe may not be teaching in the building, but his Talmidim will be teaching. And the Torah we will be teaching will be the Torah that the Rav taught us. And we will pass it on to the next generation. You know the results. Why he was worried that BMT would take over the building and the whole property. So even though they weren't prepared or anxious or interested outside of Rabbi Miller, even Rabbi Chalap, the most we can say for Rabbi Chalap, and this David didn't write, but he told me orally, at least he didn't oppose it. The others? What are you crazy? Who needs Israel? Who needs the Kanoim? They'll put the place in the Cherem. They'll do this, they'll do that. What they were worried about, 1,001 different fears. Dov? Why you now saw the building is going to Torah? They're not stupid. This is $100 million property or more. So why you to be certain that Gruss would not take over the whole campus? Said we're going to have a program too. In 1976, they sent 4 or 5 students here. I still remember them very vividly. Normie Amsel was one of them. Mark Wiener was one of them. Gil Marx was one of them. And they really didn't have a program. They came to my class in BMT, the second year class, where I was teaching already response literature. They came to, of course, the greatest person who ever taught in this campus, Nechama Leibowitz's class in Chumash. And Rabbi Miller arranged with Reb Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. They went to his home. He gave them a shiur. He was afraid to come here. He'd be put in cherem. The next year, the same concept continued, except Rabbi Lam already was president. He got Reb Avram Farbstein to agree they'd come to his home. But again, as open-minded as Reb Avram Farbstein was, and he was governor of Rosh Yeshiva. His daughter-in-law did a doctorate at Hebrew U, which no one's allowed to know about. The book on the Holocaust is her doctorate, but it doesn't. She just thanks all the professors, but nowhere does it mention that it was her doctorate. And she takes issue with me in the book. You know, you'll see the scholarship. And I answered her in class, but I would never write. Steve said, Rebbe, why don't you write and prove you're right? I said, no, I don't want to hurt her feelings. Let her think she slaughtered Aaron Rakefet. It's my pleasure. But this is an achievement. Because her husband was governor of Rosh Yeshiva afterwards, and his wife, a doctorate from Hebrew U, don't minimize it. It's been translated into English. It's available in Hebrew or in English. On the Holocaust. What's the title? I have it in my library. What's the title? No, it's Besarat HaShoah. Anyway, I had the book.
What's her name?
Esther Farbstein. It's a well-known name. So the second year they got, Rabbi Farbstein gave a shiur in his house. January 1978, Mr. Grisk would come once a year to view his investments in Israel. Whenever he would come, they would send a car for me wherever I was teaching. I'd have to leave, go with Mr. Grisk here, meet him here. Afterwards, we would have lunch together, and Mr. Grisk and I are walking through the building, and following us are Unterfuhrers, I don't know how to say that in English. If anyone wants to translate, you're welcome. Unterfuhrers, I don't know how to say it. The assistants, right from the Jewish, and Mr. Grisk would say, here, this banister has to be fixed, the guy would write down. This chair here is broken, the guy would write down. 1 month later, Mr. Grist's assistant in Israel would come to check that everything was fixed. So Mr. Grist suddenly asks me, tell me, do they have a program here for the Kollel? I say, no, not a real program. They learn in the Beis Medrash, and they attend two of the BMT classes, my second year class in the Chama Leibovitch's class, and they have something in Halacha where they go to a very famous Rosh Yeshiva's home. So Mr. Grisk says to me, no, I don't like that. And he goes back to America and he bangs on the desk. Now Rabbi Lamb already is president. And Rabbi Lamb had a million and one problems, which we'll get to. But he didn't want the headache of what's going to go on in Grisk. So, very intelligently, Rabbi Miller, Israel Miller, appointed the Baron Lichtenstein, come in once a week, you're the Rosh Kollel, give a shiur, made Reb David assistant to Rabaron, and Reb David actually ran the Kollel from the day it began with a formal program, and Reb David put a formal program together. So it began with Rav Lichtenstein. It began with Reb David Miller. The students that came the third year already, there was a bigger crowd, and some of them had been my students in BMT, and they said to me, what? You're going to be in the building and not give a shiur? And they appointed me to the faculty. Months later, why, you gave me a stipend. Okay, Baruch Hashem. When I started teaching, Nechama said to me, Ani gam rotza. Talmidim al ramani mekava. I said, Bavakasha. I spoke to the fellas. I said, fellas, why are you going to the BMT classes? Nechama is willing to give a class on the Kollel level. Great! So she joined the faculty, appointed by the students. Later, why you agreed? Nechama asked me, don't write this in the book, nothing negative has to be written, human beings. Nechama says to me, is this all they pay in YU? She couldn't believe how little we were getting. I think it was $100 a month. And, you know, all right, 1970 money, it's $100, but still it's only $100. She couldn't believe it. We were adjunct faculty. Many years later, all right, we became integrated, but it was unbelievable, and that's the way Grisk began. Over the years, we've had various teachers. Some did not catch on, and they had to leave. Some caught on and became tremendous stars. I don't have to go further than Rabbi Bednash, who graces our faculty. And you got to look high and low to find someone who knows more than Rabbi Bednash and someone who can equal his skill in teaching and exciting a class. And the way he writes on the blackboard, I came in yesterday, you know, I have it written on the blackboard. I spoke about it a simcha of a student of mine who turned 60, also a very famous student, a Rav, doctor, world famous psychologist. And I spoke about the fact that from the day I came in Aliyah, from 69 on, I never wrote on the blackboard in my classroom. For one simple reason. In YU, when I wrote on the blackboard, the students threw spitballs at me. When I came in Aliyah, I vowed I will never give them a chance to throw spitballs at me again. And Baruch Hashem, I saw Asaf every Shayur, you can't. And then the students photographed the blackboard. It's a different world today. It's beyond words. In 50 years, there won't be any rebellion, nothing. Students will come in, they'll be a master, they'll take a master teacher, they'll be watching him, they'll be photographing him, they don't have to record him, what goes on? It's unbelievable. That's the way Gris began. That's the story. One of the greatest gifts that Dr. Belkin got came about like Kliachiyat, Behesach Adat. No one could dream, no one could imagine. And here we are, so many years later, alive and kicking and thriving with so much success, both in Israel, Kanayin Hadra, tens and tens, if not hundreds of graduates have settled here, and both in America, where almost any famous rabbi you can mention was a Talmud in this very classroom. Rabbi Rosenblatt, who just came in now, Lo Aleinu, his brother-in-law, a Karban, a Kadosh, Rabbi Twesky. So Rabbi Rosenblatt embraced me, came down to meet my wife, my daughter. He remembered we was here, 80, 81, but it was like yesterday. Rabbi Goldberg, Boker, you name the name, Rabbi Weinberg, the Mashpia, Rabbi Alan Schwartz, the Rev of the Upper West Side, Eva Gris, BMT, but what became out of this building, unbelievable. Now, let me go one step further, and then I want to come to a few documents and explain myself. Tell me, have I told the truth? Ali, do you believe what I just said? You believe it. I don't believe it.
Every word, really.
No, I don't believe it. A little kid from the Bronx at DiMaggio, a cup filled with baseball Narishkeit. They're auctioning off, by the way, a love letter from Joe DiMaggio to Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at the websites today, you'll see it's big news, big news. And he writes English for a kid I think the macho didn't finish public elementary school, if I'm not mistaken. He was out playing ball. The English is not bad. His handwriting, beautiful. I recognize the handwriting anywhere. Kanayin Hara, he wasn't as stupid as they make him out to be. My dear students, even if Rakepa doesn't believe it, you have to believe it, and I'll tell you why. And the hint is right here in Washington. I had a lot of muscle because you all know in Washington I was the first one to write about what the Mossad did in Russia with the dual citizenship. And I had to get clearance and whatnot. And now I can tell everyone you don't have to believe one word I wrote because the Mossad came out with a book, B'Nitiv HaDemama. And in that book, the stars are two little people named Malka V'Aharon Rakefet. So Baruch Hashem, how do I know I've told the truth now? And by the way, would the Mossad lie? I mean, think for a minute. Don't answer the question. Let's come back to Washington. How do I know I've told the truth? Well, now I'll tell you a story. I come into the OU. The OU was before the Lana scandal broke wide open. It was a different OU then. And they had some fabulous people working there, had worked there for years. And unfortunately, everyone who was there when Lana was commandant, and whether they knew or didn't know, they all had to go. And the OU has never really recovered. If you know the inner workings, they never have recovered from all the good people they lost. Among the fabulous people they lost was a fellow named Rabbi Moshe Krupka. Rabbi Moshe Krupka today has a very, very big position, vice president in charge of academic affairs for Touro College. He is second in command to Professor Kadish. You're a fabulous individual. So Moshe was my student, listened to many shurim, never in the classroom, but via tapes, etc. And I miss him, I miss him. I don't get to see him that often. And very bright, very sensitive individual. Three brothers, second generation, a fabulous success story with the brothers. Parents survived the hell. So I'm in Moshe's office. And he's on the phone with the travel agent for the OU, David Weingarten's son. I give you details of it. And when his son hears, Moshe Kripke says, Rabbi Rakefet is with me. I must speak to him. So he gets on the phone, and his father had died earlier that year, and I had called the son, who I know from the OU, and from Machon Levra, he went in the early in the 80s, and I expressed condolences. So his David's son, David Weingarten's son, tells me, you should know that my father used to bless you every day of his life. I said, your father? I maybe met your father once, twice. No relationship with him. What's he blessing me for? He said, you don't know what you did for my father. My father put heavy money to build Horeb High School for Girls in memory of his mother. When he heard that David Yellen is coming, he went to Teddy Kolak, and he pleaded with Kolak, and he said to Mr. Kolak, you're going to have boys and girls lying on the lawn, and I don't want to describe what people you lawn can look like during the summer, during the spring months. I have these girls getting a religious education in high school. How can we manage the two? How can we have one campus next to each other? Don't give it to David Yellen. And Kolek, who could, if you've ever heard him speak Hebrew, his Hebrew was worse than his English. And in English, oh boy, he knew every cuss word that Hollywood is yet to discover. And Kolek opened up a mouth on him, get the hell out of here, you dash. What the hell do you think this is, dash, Mayan Sharim? And he says, my father went home and sat shiver for the money he put in that would go down the drain. And he says, 2 days later, my father hears a rumor that BMT is going to the campus. He calls Moshe Krona. And he says to Krona, my high. And Krona says one word, Rakefet. And he tells him the story. I said to Weingarten, to David's son, you have to live one day longer than I live, because now no one has to believe me when I tell the story. I'm going to say, if you don't believe me, I'm going to send them to you. And you fill in the details. Okay. Now the story's not complete. On this side of the ocean, Rabbi Israel Miller appointed or hired an American who had settled here. I don't know, David uses the word hired. I never knew he got a salary. Maybe he got a salary. Lenny Rosenfeld. How many of you knew Lenny Rosenfeld? Lenny Rosenfeld, Rabbi Dr. Lenny Rosenfeld, was a Talmud of Rabbi Belkin in the 1930s. He was in the first class that Mori Urebi Rav Soloveitchik taught at Yeshiva in 41 and 42. He knew both of them very well. He was the son-in-law of Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. And he was a very capable individual who went on to a very distinguished career in Jewish education. He ran the Jewish Education in the Committee of New York or Board of Education, whatever name it was known by. At that time, it was a very important position, working with day schools, working with Hebrew schools in the afternoon. Today, you don't have that many Hebrew schools at all. You have the Haredi education in New York. It's Torah Mesorah. YU is involved in a certain degree dealing with the day schools that want to be more broad, more open, more Zionist, etc. Some of them are mixed, the Torah Mesorah. I don't know what their policy is, but they certainly came out very strongly over the years against schools that had boys and girls in mixed classes. So it's not what it used to be, but at one time, the 40s into the 50s, into the 60s, Lenny Rosenfeld held a very impressive, important position. Cayman Aliyah, his children live here. Some of you know his son Ezra Rosenfeld, the Machon Lev graduate. And Lenny fought bitterly at this end for YU to open up a branch here. He corresponded with the Rav, he corresponded with Rabbi Belton. I produced part of the correspondence. First of all, it's very important historically. And secondly, it's also a monument to Lenny Rosenfeld, who today totally forgotten. And he played a key role. 1937 Yeshiva College graduate. Privileged to study with Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Got smicha in 1940, although, as I said, I believe he also studied with the Rav a year or two later. I may be incorrect on that. And I reproduce some of the correspondence. People have criticized me, the letters, you know, and it's not art scroll letters. He's not bowing over and reeling over in respect to the Rav and to Rabbi Belkin. He's hitting them very hard. But, you know, you have to see the letters in context. He was not exactly as reverential of these figures as someone who would be younger. And he hits them very hard. And he writes to the Rav, realistically speaking, your fantastic achievements in New York and Boston will be multiplied and manifold in Israel. Yes, in Israel, with all its failings and problems. You don't need me or anyone else to persuade you of the truth of this position. Just reread your own writings, your own preachments, and your own teachings. They were valid then, and even more valid today. And you see what he's saying to the Rav? Reread your Chamesh Drashot. Reread your Kol Dodi Dofeik. Wow, what you can achieve. And the Rav was frightened. He hadn't visited here since 1935. He was worried about the right wing, about the machloket here. And Lenny writes to him, your reluctance to become involved in Israeli religious politics is thoroughly sound, but your fear is exaggerated. They, the right and the left, will find you harder to digest than you will find them. Boy, that's a very sharp statement, and it is so true. Because in the Rav, as we spoke about yesterday, you will find right and left. You will find Haredicism, you will find black hat outlook and kippah shruga outlook. You will find the Rav to be a challenge to a certain degree of all the various viewpoints you can come across. Was he a hawk? Was he a dove? Politically. And he's very sharp here. They will find you harder to digest than you will find them. After the first polite and perhaps impolite gestures, they will be relieved by your withdrawal. You know what that means, withdrawal? That you're just going to be teaching Torah and Gerus. And they will quickly retreat to their own mediocre autonomy. A separation of forces will be achieved without the good offices of Dr. Kissinger. Remember the role Henry Kissinger played in the 70s? That's the reference here. Wow. Your role as a teacher par excellence will in a short time overshadow and outweigh all the political gestures, and the results will be permanent. I am suggesting the unsuggestible, that you do the undoable, that you settle permanently as a Rosh Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Please come, please decide now. You will leave relatively little behind. Your best boys will come with you, and your family will follow you. Your greatest days are ahead of you. The new yeshiva which you will fashion will be of historical import and influence. It will help shape the Israel of tomorrow. And here's the sentence, very sharp. When all is said and done, you have nothing to lose but your gullus. Can you think of a greater blessing? Could you imagine? This is Lenny Rosenfeld writing to the Rav. Now, with Dr. Belkin, no one expected Dr. Belkin to come, but what he tells Dr. Belkin is that if you don't accept this offer by Mr. Gris, you're going to lose his goodwill. And losing his goodwill, you're going to lose his money. To launch a program, he's telling Dr. Belkin what you have to do to make Mr. Gris happy. To launch a program whose content, faculty, and student body will be equal to the expectations of and do honor to Yeshiva University, the participating students, the governing committee of the Gris Center, Mr. Gris, the Israeli authorities, and the concerned Israeli public. And this is what you must do. Get ready. Think about it. Be ready. The campus is ready. We have to open in 1975. BMT actually gets the building much later and moves in September 1976. Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's writing to Rabbi Belkin, has no legitimate avenue of evasion. He was instrumental in the initial involvement with Mr. Gross. He was instrumental in the developing estrangement. He was and remains Mr. Gross's idol. For all his legitimate excuses, nevertheless, he has no escape. Far from doing him harm, Israel will be for him a new and invigorating stimulant. Dr. Belkin, please don't dismiss this as an unrealistic, wishful thinking. I have lived with this, agonized with this, and rethought this 1,000 times. There is no alternative. There is no other way. It is not a question whether to do it, but rather how to achieve it. Too much is at stake to be squeamish about methods. All who are concerned, all who are involved, all who can help, must put their heads together at once and solve the problems once and for all. Wow. What powerful correspondence. And the miracle is, it worked. So, let me just reiterate and go one step further. And we'll leave it to future generations to decide. Who knows what will ultimately happen with New York? Who would ever dream that Albert Einstein College would be given away by Yeshiva University? Who knows what the ultimate story is with the Jews in America, the campus in America, the level of Yiddishkeit in America? We have no guarantees. Gullus remains gullus. It is difficult at times for us to accept this. The Lubavitcher Rebbe could never accept it, and you all know he held that Mashiach would first come to 70-70, and from there they'll go on to Israel. I have a good friend, Jay Shapiro, came in Aliyah the time we did, became very well known in working for the Jewish Agency, wrote a book, and he describes how he goes back to Cleveland when Tel's yeshiva was thriving. This is in the mid-70s, late-70s. It's not what happened afterwards. Today, the Tel's campus in Wycliffe, Ohio is basically empty. I was in the Beis Medrash. It's shocking. Tremendous Beis Medrash, and a wall is built because B'sach HaKol, maybe there are 25, 30 students there. But this is when Tel's was thriving, and they had a little city. If you know what they had, what Stone built for them, the campus there, what that family built for them, American greeting cards. And Jay Shapiro said, I felt that their attitude was, oh, what a tragedy that there's a state of Israel and that it has to give us a little bit guilty conscience that we're not living there. So, you know, no one knows what the future holds. The German Jews were so happy, so much at home. If you're familiar with the writings of Rav Zinzendorf Hirsch and the last volume of his Gesammelte Schriften, his collected writings in English, where they reproduce the talk he gave at the 100th anniversary of Schiller's birth, and it's just overwhelming how integrated, how at home, how proud he was, and take a look what happened. But one thing I can say, Gris Campus, I can't say it's played a major role on the Israeli scene, but it's played a solid, definitive role. And who knows what the future holds. So it may be that when all is said and done, the Rav and Dr. Belkin and all their symbiotic relationship and all their complementing each other, supplementing each other, but when all is said and done, maybe their greatest achievement or one of their greatest achievements is something that happened Kliyachi Yad, and here we are in Gris, in Yerushalayim, and I have a feeling it's only going to get better and bigger here. Certain forces are at work. Baruch Hashem, a miracle in our times. Okay, yes.
Morty. How long do you stay here?
Well, the story of EMT, it's a good question, but I won't be able to go further. Let me end off the class. You asked a very good question. What happened with BMT was as follows. And you have to understand. Without understanding that, you don't understand what's happened on the Anglo scene. BMT, Machon Gold. And Machon Gold, within a year or two, Shmuley, shifted gears and emulated BMT in becoming exporting. It wasn't the attempt anymore to hit these American kids over the head with an Israeli lifestyle. I tell stories in Washington. I mean, the stories are, those two stories are classic. It captures the whole atmosphere. One story is very simple. I pull up to Gold and their girls in front of the building sitting and crying. Yeah, girls. They're young ladies in their early 20s. So I say, all right, I call them girls, what can I say? It's hard for me to call a student and a lady. Girls, what are you crying? It turned out that they had adopted a dog. They had a dog in the dormitory. And the dean at that time was Rev Shlomo Tal, who issued the siddur, the Rinat Yisrael. And he was Kulo Israeli. He was hysterical that they allowed a tamei animal, a non-kosher animal, into the dormitory. And he ripped the hell, and these girls were crying. In BMT, when the boys adopted a dog, they named him Whitey in honor of Reb Moshe Horowitz. It's a difference in mentality. In BMT, no one would have said a word. Every guy could have walked around with a dog, as long as you were learning and following the Seder HaYeshiva. Have a dog, have a monkey. The other story is even sharper. I come into the office, and Rabbi Tal is telling off a girl. Why was he telling off a girl? The girl, here, you see this paper? So the girl threw away a sheet of paper with something written on it. And he said, what are you, at Meshugat? Blozark, and he showed you right on the other side. And he starts telling her what life was like in 48 and 49. It's like the old time Israeli said, who ever heard of toilet paper? We used newspaper. And you found me, it was an ongoing conflict in mentality. So these schools shifted gears, and the Jewish agency ran them. Ah, nothing breeds success like success. Karen Biavna now started enhancing its foreign students program with Americans teaching, American mentality. Shalavim became 70% American mentality, 30% Israeli mentality. HaKotel became more American tally than Israeli. The big fight Reb Chaim Drukman had with Reb Mati Alon, what went on, Ribbono Shel Olam. No, not the fight, it was Reb Mati Alon. He was caught up with it was Chaim Drukman versus Rav Bina. That was the big fight. Reb Mati Alon was brought in. Oh, what went on? Then the girls' schools, Michala, took off. Wow. Okay, money is money. Kids are coming here. They're paying at the place today. What does a kid pay a year? $18,000. I don't know. It's unbelievable. They pay the rebellion pennies. What the heck did I make? I got paid an Israeli salary. Oh my gosh. And then the reform made inroads into the board of trustees of the Jewish agency. And they said, why do we need religious schools? Why do we need private schools? Why do we need a Torah culture department? These schools are private. Close it all down. We'll save millions of dollars. And lo and behold, by the mid-80s, everything was closed down. Torah culture became part of the general culture department with a Torah desk, a non-Torah desk. The schools were closed down. But the truth is, there was no need for these schools anymore because every last school was private, was making money, was thriving. BMT and Gold continued as private institutions, but they didn't succeed. I can tell you why you was very, very nice, and Reb David Miller probably deserves a lot of credit, that BMT owed tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, to YU when they finally closed down the operation here. Nothing was done to sue them or to go to court, to go to Basin. Okay, they closed down, and then the building was rented out to Torah Traga, and Torah Traga already is a private institution. It has fundraising, it has Rabbi Avishai David. But take a look at all these institutions. And you take a look at for instance, Reshit Yerushalayim, the whole faculty are my students, and they're Tiferet, schools for girls, these are my students, and one student after another, and especially Yeshiva, Rav Boaz Sharabi, one after another, what success. And the results? I would say as a result of BMT in 1969 with those first 10 original students, absolutely, without any doubt, there are more than 100,000 Jews living on Admat HaKodesh who are a result of that BMT, and probably a lot more. I have students who have 9 children, 10 children, the most dedicated, the most wonderful. Among our students, lo aleinu, terrible karbanot, fell in war, fell in tragedies with terrorism and what have you, but what a success story. And this is the Gris campus. Okay, now, I have a lot I want to give out. Give me another few minutes. First of all, what did we do today? Essentially, the Gris campus. Next week is a very, very fascinating shiur where we go further what Rabbi Belkin did to enhance the yeshiva. And this is the other side of Rav Shmuel Belkin, besides all the advancement. And next week we reach the unbelievable story of how the outreach of yeshiva began, what leads to the Jewish Studies program. what is it called today? Is it still called, what is it, what's the name it has today?
JSS.
JSS, what's it, the James Stryer? No, the outreach program.
Yeah.
It's James Stryer, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And that whole program begins, believe it or not, because of one basketball player who is a big star, and Yeshiva wants him, and he wants Yeshiva, but he doesn't have the knowledge to get in. Okay, now, I want to show you something interesting. Here we are. An article came out dealing with Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik by Yoel Finkelman, Contradictions in His Theological Writings. I alluded to this article in the Sunday class. I have two copies here. One is for Rabbi Rubin, and if anyone wants a copy, you're welcome to it. It's in English. It's in English. It can be passed on. We can make it.
Can I?
Yeah, so we'll copy it right after class. We'll copy it right after class. Morty, you'll come with me. You remind me to copy it. And, okay. And it's very fascinating because I spoke about it in class, but just to summarize in one sentence, people don't realize when the Rav dealt with philosophy, that was not his major thrust. When he dealt in brisk learning, he did not contradict himself. And if he contradicted himself, he had to answer. And he had to raise the question and answer. Philosophy, I view the Rav more as sermonics using modern philosophic technique. So it's very hard. If you find a contradiction, it depends when, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, he's dealing with the He was dealing with a different crowd, with different questions, with different challenges. Here, what do you say?
The Rav was a philosopher and a Rosh Hashiva. As a philosopher, he himself grew. He himself changed. So therefore, if he would have stayed the same, he wouldn't have been the Rav. The Rav developed too.
Yeah, but if the Rav developed, why doesn't he deal with his contradictions? Do you see the contradictions?
They may not be contradictions.
I am not troubled by the philosophy. I'm saying the Rav was dealing at different periods, and he used the philosophy as a vehicle to contradict them. So yeah, I may be right, I may be wrong. Who knows Rafi Gluckman? He's in the Sunday class. Anyone know him? Shmuley, give him this, okay? Now, here's an interesting article that everyone in the Kollel should read. Rabbis on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And it deals with the tragedy in Washington, D.C., but that's not the thrust of the article. The thrust of the article is too much is demanded of rabbis today. And the Rakefet solution is every shul should have a rav whose main thrust has to be to learn, to preach, to teach, to answer questions, to be the image of what a Rav should be, Taylor the Yirat Shemayim. In addition, you have an executive director who runs the shul, but you got to see the article.
You should make more copies for everybody there.
They can make copies, tell Sherry, they're big boys. This is from the blog, Emet V'Emuna, dealing with some of the problems of the fallout from Washington, D.C. Very, very fascinating material. This, to our great disgrace, appeared in the New York Times, in my humble opinion, at Temple Bethel last week. There was a public debate, a trial of Avraham Avinu for attempting to kill his son Yitzchak. It's beyond words what we have today. Mr. Spitzer, it's not exactly an ethical, moral, upright person. Of course, in the world today, I guess in Bill Clinton's world, it's fine and good and dandy. He was the district attorney, and Alan Dershowitz defended Avraham Avinu. So I have to say, as much as I have complaints against Alan Dershowitz and his level of Yiddishkeit, lo aleinu, and what became of his grandchildren, at least he defended Avraham Avinu. You should know that this machleket goes back. These Amayarets don't know it. This is the Rav. The Rav calls Pasha Darkei Dat Yitzchak the most important Pasha in the Torah. It prepares us for Jewish history. Right. And lo aleinu, just think what happened last week.
Yeah.
And David Hartman had the audacity to challenge his Rebbe and to write against his Rebbe. David Hartman is with Spitzer, And the Rav Baruch Hashem Dershowitz stands in that camp.
These are passages of the Bible that embarrass me.
Who said that? Daniel Hoffman. So I debated. There was years when they used to invite me to the radio. Today there's no longer English radio. It used to be English radio. So I once debated. The number of times I appeared, I don't know why they used to invite me, and I would go. I was younger. Today I'd say, don't waste my time, but you think you're going to change the world. So a Reform rabbi who had learned in Mir in Lakewood was dean of students at Hebrew Union College. He died young. I have his name. I have everything in my file. So he came to the discussion, the debate, with a list of psukim in the Torah that he says, Dr. Akefet, how can you live with a Bible that tells us kill the seven nations, lo techayeh kol neshama? And I answered him, after the Holocaust, you have a question like that? And I paused. Then I went into the Ramban Shita and others, you know, that if they're willing to make peace, we can accept them, etc. But after the Holocaust, you have a question? One time, it was a different time, also a Reform rabbi, on Tisha B'Av, or how can you believe in sacrifice? And God gave me the strength to say to him, right on the spot, Manny Hoser told the Rev about my answer, because it created havoc here. I said, tell me, have you driven a car lately? So the guy, of course I drive. Are you pleased with the way people drive? Are you pleased with the rate of accidents? He says, no, it's terrible. I said, well, maybe if we had sacrifice and people would see Kabbalah, they would be a lot more careful when they're driving. Oh boy, you don't know how that could come. But that's what bothered him. Then I went into the Ramban, where the Ramban describes his Akhtamah, the Sefer Vayikra. This is a magnificent article, and it's why I agree with Aaron Rakefet. We cannot teach hatred of non-Jews. We have to teach love of every human being. When someone throws rocks at me, it's a different story. Here's an article. I didn't even know about this. The Talmud sent this to me. There's a link, an interview with him. Jan Karski. This is a Polish Catholic who risked his life, who pleaded, who knew what was going on among Jews, who was undercover, who met with Roosevelt, who did everything possible to yell, to scream, to shout. And he tells you, the world didn't give a hoot. They helped Hitler kill the Jews. He's been awarded every award. He's no longer alive. And he was a professor in America afterwards. And he was made an honorary citizen of the State of Israel. Yad Vashem recognized him. I'm very proud to have learned about Jan Karski, if I'm pronouncing his first name right. What's interesting is there's a whole machloka, the exact date he was born. It's fascinating in scholarship how the nitty-gritty can lead to machloka. And finally, once again, I have another copy of Jewish Action. I spoke about this Jewish Action yesterday, how angry it got me and many others, telling people they cannot buy Israeli at Rogan next year because of Shviat. When I see the Jews in the five towns lining up to throw out the whiskey that is left over, then I'll accept perhaps what Jewish Action said. I spoke yesterday and learning there's a big difference. This is a lot less. But wow, don't buy a program from Eretz Israel. My dear students, I wouldn't miss next Sunday's class when we get into Flatbush and get into the inner workings and learn who Rabbi Solomon Shachtman was. Reb Moshe, the New York Times, wow. I wouldn't miss it for all the falafel that will be sold today in the State of Israel. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Anyone can take whatever they want over here. Temple Emmanuel. The Temple Emmanuel. The neighbor goes to his share and he prints them up. He
paid for it yesterday. You got it for free.
Oh, so tell me, where is it? I wanted to go, but I didn't know where it was.
Well, on Sunday, it's at It's called Kahal Hasidim.
Oh,
yeah, where is it?
On Rechav Bet Knesset in Sharon Desert.